for the touch of his hand, Bulgara. There was horror in Zadar's voice. It reaches down into the very depths of your soul. I know Torak for what he is. Loathsome, twisted, evil beyond our understanding of the word. But when he calls me, I must go, and what he bids me, I must do, even though my soul shrieks within me against it. Even now, as he sleeps, his fist is around my heart. There was another hoarse sob.
Didn't you know that it is impossible to resist a god? Aunt Paul asked in that same voice. Was it pride, Zadar? Were you so sure of your power that you thought you could trick him? That you could conceal your intentions from him?
Zadar sighed. Perhaps. Aldur was a gentle master. He never brought his mind down on me, so I was not prepared for what Torek did to me. Torek is not gentle. What he wants, he takes. And if he must rip out your soul in the taking, it doesn't matter to him in the slightest. You will discover his power, Bulgara. Soon he will awaken and he will destroy Belgarion. Not even the Raven King is a match for that awful mind. And then Torak will take you as his bride, as he has always said that he would. Do not resist him, Bulgara. Save yourself that agony. In the end, you will go to him anyway. You will go willingly, even eagerly.
There was a sudden scraping sound in the room beyond the iron door and a quick rush of feet.
Jarnik! Aunt Paul cried sharply. No! What's happening?
Geryon demanded of Belgareth.
That's what it means, Belgareth gasped. Get that door open! Get back, you fool!
Zadar was shouting. There was a sudden crash, the sound of bodies locked in struggle, smashing into furniture.
I warn you,
Zadar cried again.
Get back!
There was the sharp sound of a blow, of a fist striking solid bone.
Zadar!
Belgareth roared, yanking at the iron door. Then within the room there was a thunderous detonation.
Jarnik!
Aunt Paul shrieked. In a sudden burst of fury, Belgareth raised his clenched hand, joined his flaming will with his arm, and drove his fist at the iron door. The massive force of his blow ripped the locked iron door from its hinges, as if it had been no more than paper. The room beyond had a vaulted, curved ceiling supported by great iron girders, black with age. Geryon seemed to see everything in the room at once, with a curious kind of detachment, as if all emotion had been drained from him. He saw Tsinedra and Erend clinging to each other in fright beside one wall. Aunt Paul was standing as if locked in place, her eyes wide as she stared in stunned disbelief at the still form of Durnik the smith, who lay crumpled on the floor, and whose face had that deadly pale cast to it that could only mean one thing. A terrible flood of realization suddenly swept her face, a realization of an irrevocable loss.
No, she cried out. My Durnik, no!
She rushed to the fallen man, fell on her knees beside him, and gathered his still form into her arms with a heartbroken wail of grief and despair. And then Geryon saw Zadar, the apostate, for the first time. The sorcerer was also staring at Durnik's body. There was a desperate regret on his face, a knowledge that he had finally committed the one act that forever put him past all hope of redemption.
You fool, he muttered. Why? Why did you make me kill you? That's the one thing above all others that I did not want to do.
Then Belgareth, as inexorable as death itself, lunged into the room through the shattered remnants of the door, and rushed upon the man he had once called brother. Zadar flinched back from the old sorcerer's awful rage.
I didn't mean to do it, Belgareth,
he quavered, his hands raised to ward off Belgareth's rush.
The fool tried to attack me. He was...
You, Belgarath grated at him from between teeth clenched with hate. You, you. But he was past speech. No word could contain his rage. He raised both arms and struck at Zadar's face with his fists. Zadar reeled back, but Belgarath was upon him, grappling, pounding at him with his hands. Geryon could feel flickers of will from one or the other of them, but caught up an emotion so powerful that they erased thought. Neither was coherent enough to focus the force within him. And so, like two tavern brawlers, they rolled on the floor, kicking, gouging, pounding at each other, Belgarath consumed with fury, and Zadar with fear and chagrin. Desperately, the apostate jerked a dagger from the sheath at his waist, and Belgarath seized his wrist in both hands and pounded it on the floor until the knife went skittering away. Then each struggled to reach the dagger, clawing and jerking at each other, their faces frozen into intense grimaces, as each strove to reach the dagger first. At some point during the frenzied seconds when they had burst into the room, Geryon had, unthinking, drawn the great sword from its sheath across his back, but the orb and the blade were cold and unresponsive in his hand as he stood watching the deadly struggle between the two sorcerers. Belgarath's hands were locked about Zadar's throat, and Zadar, strangling, clawed desperately at the old man's arms. Belgarath's face was contorted into an animal snarl, his lips drawn back from clenched teeth as he throttled his ancient enemy. As if finally driven past all hope of sanity, he struggled to his feet, dragging Zadar up with him. Holding the apostate by the throat with one hand, he began to rain blows on him with the other. Then, between one blow and the next, he swung his arm down and pointed at the stones beneath their feet. With a dreadful grinding, a great crack appeared, zigzagging across the floor. The rocks shrieked in protest as the crack widened. Still struggling, the two men toppled and fell into the yawning fissure. The earth seemed to shudder. With a terrible sound, the crack ground shut. Incredulously, his mouth suddenly agape, Geryon stared in stunned disbelief at the scarcely discernible crack through which the two men had fallen. Tenedra screamed, her hands going to her face in horror. "Do something!" Silk shouted at Geryon. But Geryon could only stare at him in blank incomprehension. Bolgara, Silk said desperately, turning to Aunt Paul. Still incapacitated by her sudden overwhelming grief, she could not respond, but knelt with Dernick's lifeless body in her arms, weeping uncontrollably as she rocked back and forth, holding him tightly against her. From infinitely far beneath, there was a sullen detonation and then another. Even in the bowels of the earth, the deadly struggle continued. As if compelled, Geryon's eyes sought out the embrasure in the far wall. There, in the dim light, he could make out the recumbent form of Kal Torak. Strangely emotionless, Geryon stared at the form of his enemy, meticulously noting every detail. He saw the black robe, the polished mask. He saw Trechgoru, Torak's great black sword. Although he did not, could not, move or even feel, a struggle nonetheless raged inside him, a struggle perhaps even more dreadful than that which had just plunged Belgarath and Zadar into the depths of the earth. The two forces which had first diverged and then turned and rushed at each other down the endless corridors of time had finally met within him. The event, which was the ultimate conclusion of the two prophecies, had begun, and its first skirmishes were taking place within Geryon's mind. Minute and very subtle adjustments were shifting some of his most deeply ingrained attitudes and perceptions. Torak moved, stirring restlessly, as those same two forces met within him. Dreadful flashes of the sleeping god's mind assailed Geryon, and he saw clearly the terrible subterfuge that lay behind Torak's offer of friendship and love. Had his fear of their duel drawn him into yielding, fully half of creation would have shimmered and vanished. More than that, what Torak had offered was not love, but an enslavement so vile that it was beyond imagining. But he had not yielded. He had somehow evaded the overwhelming force of Torak's mind, and had placed himself utterly in the hands of the prophecy that had drawn him here. With an absolute denial of self, he had become the instrument of the prophecy. He was no longer afraid. Sword in hand, the child of light awaited the moment when the prophecy would release him to join in deadly struggle with the dark god. Then, even as Silk desperately tried to arouse either Garion or Polgara to action, the stones of the floor buckled upward, and Belgarath rose from the earth. Garion, still abstracted and bemused, saw that all traces of the sometimes foolish old man he had known before were gone. The thieving old storyteller had vanished. Even the irritable old man who had led the quest for the orb no longer existed. In their place stood the form of Belgarath the Sorcerer, the Eternal Man, shimmering in the aura of his full power. Chapter 23.
"Where is Zadar?"
Aunt Paul asked, raising her tear-streaked face from Durnik's lifeless body to stare with a dreadful intensity at her father.
"I left him down there," Belgarath replied bleakly.
"Dead?"
"No."
"Bring him back."
"Why?"
"To face me."
Her eyes burned. The old man shook his head.
"No, Paul,"
he said to her.
"You have never killed anyone. Let's leave it that way."
She gently lowered Durnik's body to the floor and rose to her feet, her pale face twisted with grief and an awful need.
"Then I will go to him,"
she declared, raising both arms as if to strike at the earth beneath her feet.
"No,"
Belgarath told her, extending his own hand.
"You will not."
They stood facing each other, locked in a dreadful, silent struggle. Aunt Paul's look at first was one of annoyance at her father's interference. She raised one arm again to bring the force of her will crashing down at the earth, but once again Belgarath put forth his hand.
"Let me go, father."
"No."
She redoubled her efforts, twisting as if trying to free herself from his unseen restraint.
"Let me go, old man," she cried.
"No. Don't do this, Paul. I don't want to hurt you."
She tried again, more desperately this time, but once again Belgarath smothered her will with his. His face hardened, and he set his jaw. In a last effort, she flung the whole force of her mind against the barrier that he had erected. Like some great rock, however, the old man remained firm. Finally, her shoulders slumped, and she turned, knelt beside Durnek's body, and began to weep again.
"I am sorry, Paul,"
he said gently.
"I never wanted to have to do that. Are you all right?"
"How can you ask that?"
she demanded brokenly, wringing her hands over Durnik's silent body.
"That's not what I meant."
She turned her back on him and buried her face in her hands.
"I don't think you could have reached him anyway, Paul,"
the old man told her.
"You know as well as I that what one of us does, another cannot undo."
Silk, his ferret-like face shocked, spoke in a hushed voice.
"What did you do to him?"
"I took him down until we came to solid rock, and then I sealed him up in it."
"Can't he just come up out of the earth the way you did?"
"No. That's impossible for him now. Sorcery is a thought, and no man can exactly duplicate the thought of another. Zadar is imprisoned inside the rock forever, or until I choose to free him."
The old man looked mournfully at Durnik's body.
"And I don't think I'll choose to do that."
"He'll die, won't he?"
Belgarath shook his head.
"No, That was part of what I did to him. He will lie inside the rock until the end of days.
That is monstrous, Belgarath,
Silk said in a sick voice.
So was that, Belgarath replied grimly, pointing to Durnek.
Geryon could hear what they were saying, and could see them all quite clearly. But it seemed somehow that they were actually someplace else. The others in the underground crypt seemed to be on the periphery of his attention. For him, there was only one other in the vaulted chamber, and that other was Kal Torak, his enemy.
The restless stirring of the drowsing god became more evident. Geryon's peculiarly multiple awareness, in part his own, in part derived from the orb, and as ever overlaid by the consciousness which he had always called the dry voice in his mind, perceived in that stirring the pain that lay beneath the maimed god's movements. Torak was actually writhing as he half slept. An injured man would heal in time, and his pain would gradually diminish and ultimately disappear, because injury was a part of the human condition. A man was born to be hurt from time to time, and the mechanism for recovery was born within him. A god, on the other hand, was invulnerable, and he had no need for the ability to heal. Thus it was with Torak. The fire, which the orb had loosed upon him when he had used it to crack the world, still seared his flesh, and his pain had not diminished in the slightest down through all of the endless centuries since his maiming. Behind that steel mask, the flesh of the dragon god's face still smoked, and his burned eye still boiled endlessly in the socket. Geryon shuddered, almost pitying that perpetual agony. The child Erend pulled himself free from Zenedra's trembling arms and crossed the flagstone floor of the tomb, his small face intent. He stopped, bent, and put his hand on Durnek's shoulder. Gently, he shook the dead man, as if trying to wake him. His little face became puzzled when the smith did not respond. He shook again, a bit harder, his eyes uncomprehending.
Erend, Zenedra called to him, her voice breaking. Come back. There is nothing we can do.
Erend looked at her, then back to Durnek. Then he gently patted the smith's shoulder with a peculiar little gesture, sighed, and went back to the princess. She caught him suddenly in her arms and began to weep, burying her face against his body. Once again, with that same curious little gesture, he patted her flaming hair. Then from the alcove in the far wall there came a long, rasping sigh, a shuddering expiration of breath. Geryon looked sharply toward the alcove, his hand tightening on the hilt of his cold sword. Torak had turned his head, and his eyes were open. The hideous fire burned in the eye that was not as the god came awake. Belgarath drew in his breath in a sharp hiss as Torak raised the charred stump of his left hand, as if to brush away the last of his sleep, even as his right hand groped for the massive hilt of Krekgoru, his black sword.
Geryon,
Belgarath said sharply. But Geryon, still locked in stasis by the forces focusing upon him, could only stare at the awakening god, a part of him struggling to shake free, and his hand trembling as he fought to lift his sword.
Not yet, the voice whispered.
Geryon!
Belgarath actually shouted this time. Then, in a move seemingly born of desperation, the old sorcerer lunged past the bemused young man to fling himself upon the still recumbent form of the dark god. Torak's hand released the hilt of his sword, and almost contemptuously grasped the front of Belgarath's tunic. Lifting the struggling old man from him as one might lift a child, the steel mask twisted into an ugly sneer as the god held the helpless sorcerer out from him. Then, like a great wind,
The force of Torak's mind struck, hurling Belgarath across the room, ripping away the front of his tunic. Something glittered across Torak's knuckles, and Geryon realized that it was the silver chain of Belgarath's amulet, the polished medallion of the Standing Wolf. In a very peculiar way, the medallion had always been the center of Belgarath's power, and now it lay in the grip of his ancient enemy. With a dreadfully slow deliberation, the dark god rose, towering over them all, Krech-Goru in his hand.
"Geryon, do something!"
Tenedra screamed. With deadly pace, Torak strode toward the dazed Belgarath, raising his sword. But Aunt Paul sprang to her feet and threw herself between them. Slowly, Torak lowered his sword, and then he smiled a loathsome smile.
"My bride,"
he rasped in a horrid voice.
"Never, Torak."
He ignored her defiance.
"Thou hast come to me at last, Balgara,"
he gloated.
"I have come to watch you die."
"Die, Balgara? Me? No, my bride. That is not why thou hast come. My will has drawn thee to me as was foretold. And now thou art mine. Come to me, my beloved."
"Never."
"Never, Balgara?"
There was a dreadful insinuation in the god's rasping voice.
"Thou wilt submit to me, my bride. I will bend thee to my will. Thy struggle shall but make my victory over thee the sweeter. In the end, I will have thee. Come here."
So overwhelming was the force of his mind that she swayed almost as a tree sways in the grip of a great wind.
"No,"
she gasped, closing her eyes and turning her face away sharply.
"Look at me, Balgara,"
he commanded, his voice now almost purring.
"I am thy fate. All that thou didst think to love before me shall fall away, and thou shalt love only me. Look at me."
Helplessly she turned her head and opened her eyes to stare at him. The hatred and defiance seemed to melt out of her, and a terrible fear came into her face.
"Thy will crumbles, my beloved. Now come to me."
She must resist.
All the confusion was gone now, and Geryon understood at last. This was the real battle. If Aunt Paul succumbed, they were all lost. It had all been for this.
"Help her,"
the voice within him said.
"Aunt Paul,"
Geryon threw the thought at her,
"remember Durnik."
He knew, without knowing how he knew, that this was the one thing that could sustain her in her deadly struggle. He ranged through his memory now, throwing images of Durnik at her, of the smith's strong hands at work at his forge, of his serious eyes, of the quiet sound of his voice, and most of all, of the good man's unspoken love for her, the love that had been the center of Durnik's entire life. She had begun involuntarily to move, no more than a slight shifting of her weight in preparation for that first fatal step in response to Torak's overpowering command. Once she had made that step, she would be lost. But Geryon's memories of Durnik struck her like a blow. Her shoulders, which had already begun to droop in defeat, suddenly straightened, and her eyes flashed with renewed defiance.
"Never,"
she told the expectantly waiting god.
"I will not."
Torak's face slowly stiffened. His eyes blazed as he brought the full crushing force of his will to bear upon her, but she stood firmly against all that he could do, clinging to the memory of Durnik, as if to something so solid that not even the will of the Dark God could tear it from her. A look of baffled frustration contorted Torak's face as he perceived that she would never yield, that her love would be forever denied to him. She had won, and her victory was like a knife twisting slowly inside him. Thwarted, enraged, maddened by her now unalterable will to resist, Torak raised his face and suddenly howled, a shocking, animal-like sound of overwhelming frustration.
"Then perish both," he raged. "Die with thy father."
And with that, he once more raised his deadly sword. Unflinching, Ant-Paul faced the raging god.
"Now, Belgarion,"
the voice cracked in Geryon's mind. The orb, which had remained cold and dead throughout all the dreadful confrontation between Ant-Paul and the maimed god, suddenly flared into life, and the sword of the Riven King exploded into fire, filling the crypt with an intense blue light. Geryon leaped forward, extending his sword to catch the deadly blow which was already descending upon Ant-Paul's unprotected face. The steel sound of blade against blade was like the striking of a great bell, and it rang within the crypt, shimmering and echoing from the walls. Torak's sword, deflected by the flaming blade, plowed a shower of sparks from the flagstone floor. The god's single eye widened as he recognized all in one glance the Riven King, the flaming sword, and the blazing orb of Aldur. Geryon saw in the look that Torak had already forgotten Ant-Paul, and that now the maimed god's full attention was focused on him.
"And so, thou hast come at last, Belgarion,"
the god greeted him gravely.
"I have awaited thy coming since the beginning of days. Thy fate awaits thee here. Hail, Belgarion, and farewell."
His arm lashed back, and he swung a vast blow. But Geryon, without even thinking, raised his own sword, and once again the crypt rang with the bell note of blade against blade.
"Thou art but a boy, Belgarion. Wilt thou pit thyself against the might and invincible will of a god? Submit to me, and I will spare thy life."
The will of the god of Angarak was now directed at him, and in that instant Geryon fully understood how hard Ant-Paul's struggle had been. He felt the terrible compulsion to obey, draining the strength from him. But suddenly, a vast chorus of voices rang down through all of the centuries to him, crying out the single word, "No!" All the lives of all who preceded him had been directed at this one moment, and those lives infused him now. Though he alone held Iron Grip's sword, Belgarion of Riva was not alone, and Torak's will could not sway him. In a move of absolute defiance, Geryon again raised his flaming sword.
"So be it then,"
Torak roared at him.
"To the death, Belgarion!"
At first it seemed but some trick of the flickering light that filled the tomb, but almost as soon as that thought occurred, Geryon saw that Torak was growing larger, swelling upward, towering, expanding. With an awful wrenching sound, he shouldered aside the rusted iron roof of the tomb, bursting upward. Once again, without thinking, without even stopping to consider how to do it, Geryon also began to expand, and he, too, exploded through the confining ceiling, shuddering away the rusty debris as he rose. In open air, among the decaying ruins of the City of Night, the two titanic adversaries faced each other beneath the perpetual cloud that blotted out the sky.
"The conditions are met,"
the dry voice spoke through Geryon's lips.
"So it would seem."
Another equally unemotional voice came from Torak's steel-encased mouth.
"Do you wish to involve the others?"
Geryon's voice asked.
"It hardly seems necessary. These two have sufficient capacity for what must be brought to bear upon them."
"Then let it be decided here."
"Agreed."
And with that, Geryon felt a sudden release as all constraint was removed from him. Torak, also released, raised Krekhgoru, his lips drawn back in a snarl of hate. Their struggle was immense. Rocks shattered beneath the colossal force of deflected blows. The sword of the Riven King danced in blue flames, and Krekhgoru, Torak's blade of shadows, swept a visible darkness with it at every blow. Beyond thought, beyond any emotion but blind hatred, the two swung and parried and lurched through the broken ruins, crushing all beneath them. The elements themselves erupted as the fight continued. The wind shrieked through the rotting city, tearing at the trembling stones. Lightning seethed about them, glaring and flickering. The earth rumbled and shook beneath their massive feet. The featureless cloud that had concealed the City of Night beneath its dark mantle for 5 millennia began to boil and race above them. Great patches of stars appeared and disappeared in the roiling middle of the surging cloud. The Grolems, both human and non-human, aghast at the towering struggle that had suddenly erupted in their very midst, fled, shrieking in terror. Geryon's blows were directed at Torak's blind side, and the dark god flinched from the fire of the orb each time the flaming sword struck. But the shadow of Krekhgoru put a deathly chill into Geryon's blood each time it passed over him. They were more evenly matched than Geryon had imagined possible. Torak's advantage of size had been erased when they had both swelled into immensity, and Geryon's inexperience was offset by Torak's maiming. It was the uneven ground that betrayed Geryon. Retreating before a sudden flurry of massive blows, he felt one heel catch on a heap of tumbled rock, and the rotten stones crumbled and rolled beneath his feet. Despite his scrambling attempt to keep his balance, he fell. Torak's single eye blazed in triumph as he raised the dark sword, but, seizing his sword hilt in both hands, Geryon raised his burning blade to meet that vast blow. When the swords struck edge to edge, a huge shower of sparks cascaded down over Geryon. Again Torak raised Krekhgoru, but a strange hunger flickered across his steel-encased face.
"Yield!" he roared.
Geryon stared up at the huge form towering over him, his mind racing.
"I have no wish to kill thee, boy,"
Torak said.
"Yield, and I will spare thy life," he said it almost pleading.
And then Geryon understood. His enemy was not trying to kill him, but was striving instead to force him to submit. Torak's driving need was for domination. This was where the real struggle between them lay.
"Throw down thy sword, child of light. Bow before me,"
the god commanded, and the force of his mind was like a crushing weight. "I will not," Geryon gasped, wrenching away from that awful compulsion. "You may kill me, but I will not yield." Torak's face twisted, as if his perpetual agony had been doubled by Geryon's refusal.
"Thou must,"
he almost sobbed.
"Thou art helpless before me. Submit to me."
"No!" Geryon shouted, and taking advantage of Torak's chagrin at that violent rejection, he rolled out from under the shadow of Krekhgoru and sprang again to his feet. Everything was clear now, and he knew at last how he could win.
"Hear me, maimed and despised god," he grated from between clenched teeth. "You are nothing. Your people fear you, but they do not love you. You tried to deceive me into loving you. You tried to force Aunt Paul to love you. But I refuse you, even as she did.
You are a god, but you're nothing. In all the universe, there's not one person, not one thing that loves you. You are alone and empty, and even if you kill me, I will still win. Unloved and despised, you will howl out your miserable life to the end of days.
Geryon's words struck the maimed god like blows, and the orb, as if echoing those words, blazed anew, lashing at the dragon god with its consuming hatred. This was the event for which the universe had waited since the beginning of time. This was why Geryon had come to this decaying ruin, not to fight Torak, but to reject him. With an animal howl of anguish and rage, the Child of Dark raised Thrakhgorru above his head and ran at the Raven King. Geryon made no attempt to ward off the blow, but gripped the hilt of his flaming sword in both hands, and, extending his blade before him, he lunged at his charging enemy. It was so easy. The sword of the Raven King slid into Torak's chest like a stick into water. And as it ran into the god's suddenly stiffening body, the power of the orb surged up the flaring blade. Torak's vast hand opened convulsively, and Thrakhgorru tumbled harmlessly from his grip. He opened his mouth to cry out, and blue flame gushed like blood from his mouth. He clawed at his face, ripping away the polished steel mask to reveal the hideously maimed features that had lain beneath. Tears started from his eyes, both the eye that was and the eye that was not. But the tears were also fire, for the sword of the Raven King buried in his chest filled him with its flame. He lurched backward. With a steely slither, the sword slid out of his body. But the fire the blade had ignited within him did not go out. He clutched the gaping wound, and blue flame spurted out between his fingers, spattering in little burning pools among the rotting stones about him. His maimed face, still streaked with fiery tears, contorted in agony. He lifted that burning face to the heaving sky and raised his vast arms. In mortal anguish, the stricken god cried to heaven,
"Mother!"
And the sound of his voice echoed from the farthest star. He stood so for a frozen moment, his arms upraised in supplication. And then he tottered. Then he fell dead at Geryon's feet. For an instant, there was absolute silence. Then a howling cry started at Torak's dead lips, fading into unimaginable distance as the dark prophecy fled, taking the inky shadow of Thrakhgorru with it. Again there was silence. The racing clouds overhead stopped at once in their maddest plunge, and the stars that had appeared among the tatters of that cloud went out. The entire universe shuddered and stopped. There was a moment of absolute darkness, as all light everywhere went out, and all motion ceased. In that dreadful instant, all that existed, all that had been, all that was yet to be, was wrenched suddenly into the course of one prophecy. Where there had always been two, there was now but one. And then, faint at first, the wind began to blow, purging away the rotten stink of the city of night, and the stars came on again like suddenly re-illuminated jewels on the velvety throat of night. As the light returned, Geryon stood wearily over the body of the god he had just killed. His sword still flickered blue in his hand, and the orb exulted in the vaults of his mind. Vaguely he was aware that in that shuddering moment when all light had died, both he and Torak had returned to their normal size. But he was too tired to wonder about it. From the shattered tomb not far away, Belgarath emerged, shaken and drawn. The broken chain of his medallion dangled from his tightly clenched hand, and he stopped to stare for a moment at Geryon and the fallen god. The wind moaned in the shattered ruins, and somewhere, far off in the night, the hounds of Torak howled a mournful dirge for their fallen master. Belgarath straightened his shoulders. Then, in a gesture peculiarly like that which Torak had made in the moment of his death, he raised his arms to the sky.
"Master," he cried out in a huge voice, "it is finished."
Chapter 24. It was over, but there was a bitterness in the taste of Geryon's victory. A man did not lightly kill a god, no matter how twisted or evil that god might be. And so, Belgarion of Reva stood sadly over the body of his fallen enemy, as the wind, smelling faintly of the approaching dawn, washed over the decaying ruins of the City of Night.
"Regrets, Geryon?" Belgarath asked quietly, putting his hand on his grandson's shoulder.
Geryon sighed. "No, grandfather. I suppose not. Not really. It had to be done, didn't it?"
Belgarath nodded gravely.
"It's just that he was so alone at the end. I took everything away from him before I killed him. I'm not very proud of that."
"As you say, it had to be done. It was the only way you could beat him."
"I just wish I could have left him something, that's all."
From the ruins of the shattered iron tower, a sad little procession emerged. Aunt Paul, Silk, and Tenedra were bringing out the body of Durnik the smith, and walking gravely beside them came Erand. A pang of almost unbearable grief ran through Geryon. Durnik, his oldest friend, was pale and dead, and in that vast internal upheaval that had preceded the duel with Torak, Geryon had not even been able to mourn.
"It was necessary, you understand,"
Belgarath said sadly.
"Why? Why did Durnik have to die, grandfather?"
Geryon's voice was anguished, and tears stood openly in his eyes.
"Because his death gave your Aunt Paul the will to resist Torak. That has always been the one flaw in the prophecy. The possibility that Paul might yield. All Torak needed was one person to love him. It would have made him invincible."
"What would have happened if she had gone to him?"
"You would have lost the fight. That's why Durnik had to die."
The old man sighed regretfully.
"I wish it could have been otherwise. But it was inevitable."
The three who had borne Durnik from the broken tomb gently laid his still form on the ground, and Tenedra sadly joined Belgarath and Geryon. Wordlessly, the tiny girl slipped her hand into Geryon's, and the three of them stood silently watching as Aunt Paul, past tears now, gently straightened Durnik's arms at his sides, and then covered him with her cloak. She sat then upon the earth, took his head into her lap, and almost absently stroked his hair, her head bowed over his in her grief.
"I cannot bear it,"
Tenedra suddenly sobbed, and she buried her face in Geryon's shoulder and began to weep.
Then there was a light, where there had been only darkness before.
As Geryon stared, a single beam of brilliant blue light descended from the broken and tattered cloud rolling overhead. The entire ruin seemed bathed in its intense radiance as the light touched the earth. Like a great glowing column, the beam of light reached down to the earth from the night sky and was joined by other beams, red and yellow and green, and shades Geryon could not even name. Like the colors at the foot of a sudden rainbow, the great columns of light stood side by side on the other side of Torak's fallen body. Then, indistinctly, Geryon perceived that a glowing incandescent figure stood within the center of each column of light. The gods had returned to mourn the passing of their brother. Geryon recognized Aldur, and he could easily identify each of the others. Mara still wept,
And dead-eyed Issa seemed to undulate in his serpent-like manner as he stood within his glowing column of pale green light. Nedra's face was shrewd, and Kaldan's proud. Belar, the blonde-haired boyish god of the Elorns, had a roguish, impudent look about him, though his face, like those of his brothers, was sad at the death of Torak. The gods had returned to Earth in glowing light, and with sound as well. The reeking air of Tol Mishrak was suddenly alive with that sound, as each colored beam of light gave off a different note, the notes joining in a harmony so profound that it seemed the answer to every question that had ever been asked. Finally, joining the other columns of light, a single, blindingly white beam slowly descended, and within the center of that radiance stood the white-robed form of Ul, that strange god whom Geryon had seen once in Prolgu. The figure of Aldor, still embraced in its glowing blue nimbus, approached the ancient god of Ulgo.
"Father," Aldor said sadly,
"our brother,
thy son Torak, is slain."
Shimmering and incandescent, the form of Ul, father of the other gods, moved across the rubble-strewn ground to stand over the silent body of Torak.
"I tried to turn thee from this path, my son," he said softly,
and a single tear coursed its way down his eternal cheek. Then he turned back to Aldor.
"Take up the form of thy brother, my son. Place it upon some more suitable resting place. It grieves me to see him lie so low upon the earth."
Aldor, joined by his brethren, took up the body of Torak and placed it upon a large block of stone lying amid the ancient ruins. Then, standing in a quiet, gleaming circle about the bier, they mourned the passing of the god of Engrak. Unafraid as always, seemingly not even aware that the glowing figures which had descended from the sky were not human, Erend walked quite confidently to the shining form of Ul. He reached out his small hand and tugged insistently at the god's robe.
"Father,"
he said. Ul looked down at the small face.
"Father,"
Erend repeated, perhaps echoing Aldor, who had, in his use of that name, revealed at last the true identity of the god of Ulgo.
"Father,"
the little boy said again. Then he turned and pointed at the silent form of Durnik.
"Erend."
It was in some strange way more a command than a request. The face of Ul became troubled.
"It is not possible, child."
"Father,"
the little boy insisted.
"Erend."
Ul looked inquiringly at Geryon, his eyes profoundly unsettled.
"The child's request is serious," he said gravely,
speaking not to Geryon, but to that other awareness.
"And it places an obligation upon me, but it crosses the uncrossable boundary."
"The boundary must remain intact," the dry voice replied through Geryon's lips. "Thy sons are passionate, holy Ul, and having once crossed this line, they may be tempted to do so again, and perhaps in one such crossing they may change that which must not be changed. Let us not provide the instrumentality whereby destiny must once more follow two divergent paths." All sighed. "Wilt thou and thy sons, however, lend of your power to my instrument, so that he may cross the boundary?" Ul looked startled at that. "Thus will the boundary be protected, and thine obligation shall be met. It can happen in no other way."
"Let it be as thou wilt,"
Ul agreed. He turned then, and a peculiar look passed between the father of the gods and his eldest son, Aldor. Aldor, still bathed in blue light, turned from his sad contemplation of his dead brother toward Aunt Paul, who was still bowed over Durnik's body.
"Be comforted, my daughter," he told her. "His sacrifice was for thee, and for all mankind.
"That is slight comfort, master,"
she replied, her eyes full of tears.
"This was the best of men."
"All men die, my daughter, the best as well as the worst. In thy life thou hast seen this many times."
"Yes, master, but this is different."
"In what way, beloved Polgara?"
Aldor seemed to be pressing her for some reason. Aunt Paul bit her lip.
"Because I loved him, master,"
she replied finally. The faintest touch of a smile appeared on Aldor's lips.
"Is that so difficult to say, my daughter?"
She could not answer, but bowed again over Durnick's lifeless form.
"Wouldst thou have us restore this man to thee, my daughter?"
Aldor asked then. Her face came up sharply.
"That isn't possible, master. Please, don't toy with my grief like this."
"Let us, however, consider that it may be possible. Wouldst thou have us restore him?"
"With all my heart, master."
"To what end? What task hast thou for this man that demands his restoration?"
She bit her lip again.
"To be my husband, master,"
she blurted finally, with a trace of defiance in her voice.
"And was that also so very difficult to say? Art thou sure, however, that this love of thine derives not from thy grief, and that once this good man is restored, thy mind might not turn away from him? He is, thou must admit, most ordinary."
"Durnick has never been ordinary,"
she flared with sudden heat. "He is the best and bravest man in the world."
"I meant him no disrespect, Polgara, but no power doth infuse him. The force of the will and the word is not in him."
"Is that so important, master?"
"Marriage must be a joining of equals, my daughter. How could this good, brave man be husband to thee, so long as thy power remains?"
She looked at him helplessly.
"Couldst thou, Polgara, limit thyself? Wouldst thou become his equal, with power no more than his?"
She stared at him, hesitated, then blurted the one word.
"Yes."
Geryon was shocked, not so much by Aunt Paul's acceptance, but rather by Aldor's request. Aunt Paul's power was central to her very being. To remove it from her would leave her with nothing. What would she be without it? How could she even live without it? It was a cruel price to demand, and Geryon had believed that Aldor was a kindly god.
"I will accept thy sacrifice, Polgara,"
Aldor was saying.
"I will speak with my father and my brothers. For good and proper reasons, we have denied ourselves this power, and we must all agree to it before any of us might attempt this violation of the natural order of things."
And he returned to the sorrowful gathering about Toraxbear.
"How could he do that?"
His arm still about Tenedra, Geryon demanded his question of his grandfather.
"Do what?"
"Ask her to give up her powers like that. Won't it destroy her?"
"She is much stronger than you think, Geryon,"
Belgarath assured him.
"And Aldo's reasoning is sound. No marriage could survive that kind of inequality."
Among the glowing gods, however, one angry voice was raised.
"No."
It was Mara, the weeping god of the Marags, who were no more.
"Why should one man be restored when all my slaughtered children still lie cold and dead? Did Aldor hear my pleas? Did he come to my aid when my children died? I will not consent." "I hadn't counted on that,"
Belgarath muttered.
I had better take steps before this goes any further.
He crossed the littered ground and bowed respectfully.
Forgive my intrusion, he said. But would my master's brother accept a woman of the Marags as a gift in exchange for his aid in restoring Durnik?
Mara's tears, which had been perpetual, suddenly stopped and his face became incredulous.
A Marag woman?
None such exist. I would have known in my heart if one of my children had survived in Maragor.
Of a certainty, Lord Mara,
Belgarath agreed quickly.
But what of those few who were carried out of Maragor to dwell in perpetual slavery?
Knowest thou of such a one, Belgarath?
Mara asked with a desperate eagerness.
The old man nodded. We discovered her in the slave pens beneath Rakhthal, Lord Mara. Her name is Tiber. She is but one, but a race may be restored by such a one as she, particularly if she be watched over by a loving god.
Where is Tiber, my daughter?
In the care of Relg, the Ulgo, Belgarath replied. They seem quite attached to each other.
Mara looked at him thoughtfully.
A race may not be restored by one, even in the care of the most loving god. It requires two.
He turned to Ul.
Wilt thou give me this Ulgo, father? He shall become the sire of my people.
Ul gave Belgarath a rather penetrating look.
Thou knowest that Relg hath another duty to perform, he said pointedly.
Belgarath's expression was almost impish.
I'm certain the Gorum and I can work out the details most wholly, he declared with utmost self-confidence.
Aren't you forgetting something, Belgarath?
Silk asked diffidently, as if not wanting to intrude.
Relg has this little problem, remember?
Belgarath gave the little man a hard look.
I thought I ought to mention it, Silk said innocently.
Mara looked sharply at them.
What is this?
A minor difficulty, Lord Mara, Belgarath said quickly. One that I'm certain Tiber can overcome. I have the utmost confidence in her in that particular area.
I will have the truth of this, Mara said firmly.
Belgarath sighed and gave Silk another grim look.
Relg is a zealot, Lord Mara. For religious reasons, he avoids certain, forms of human contact.
Fatherhood is his destiny, Ul said. From him will issue a special child. I will explain this to him. He is an obedient man, and he will put aside his aversions for my sake.
Then thou wilt give him to me, father?
Mara asked eagerly.
He is thine, with but one restriction, of which we will speak later.
Let us see to this brave Sindar, then,
Mara said, and all traces of his weeping were now gone.
Belgarion,
the voice in Garion's mind said.
What? The restoration of your friend is in your hands now.
Me? Why me?
Must you always say that? Do you want Durnik's life restored?
Well, of course, but I can't do it. I wouldn't even know where to begin.
You did it before. Remember the colt in the cave of the gods?
Garion had almost forgotten that.
You are my instrument, Belgarion. I can keep you from making mistakes, most of the time anyway. Just relax. I'll show you what to do.
Garion was already moving without conscious volition. He let his arms fall from about Senedra's shoulders, and his sword still in his hand, he walked slowly toward Aunt Paul and Durnik's body. He looked once into her eyes as she sat with the dead man's head in her lap, and then he knelt beside the body.
For me, Garion,
she murmured to him.
"If I can, Aunt Paul."
Then, without knowing why, he laid the sword of the Riven King upon the ground and took hold of the orb at its pommel. With a faint click, the orb came free in his hand. Arend, smiling now, approached from the other side and also knelt. Taking up Durnick's lifeless hand in his, holding the orb in both hands, Geryon reached out and put it against the dead man's chest. He was faintly conscious of the fact that the gods had gathered about in a circle, and that they had reached out their arms, palm to palm, forming an unbroken ring. Within that circle, a great light began to pulsate, and the orb, as if in answer, glowed between his hands. The blank wall he had seen once before was there again, still black, impenetrable, silent. As he had before in the Cave of the Gods, Geryon pushed tentatively against the substance of death itself, striving to reach through and pull his friend back into the world of the living. It was different this time. The colt he had brought to life in the cave had never lived except within its mother's body. Its death had been as tenuous as its life, and it lay but a short distance beyond the barrier. Durnick, however, had been a man full grown, and his death, like his life, was far more profound. With all of his strength, Geryon pushed. He could feel the enormous force of the combined wills of the gods joining with his in the silent struggle, but the barrier would not yield. "Use the orb," the voice commanded. This time Geryon focused all the power, his own and that of the gods, upon the round stone between his hands. It flickered, then glowed, then flickered again.
"Help me,"
Geryon commanded it. As if suddenly understanding, the orb flared into a coruscating eruption of colored light. The barrier was weakening. With an encouraging little smile, Arend reached out and laid one hand upon the blazing orb. The barrier broke. Durnick's chest heaved, and he coughed once. With profoundly respectful expressions upon their eternal faces, the gods stepped back. Aunt Paul cried out in sudden relief and clasped her arms about Durnick, cradling him against her.
"Arend,"
the child said to Geryon, with a peculiar note of satisfaction. Geryon stumbled to his feet, exhausted by the struggle, and nearly staggering as he moved away.
"Are you all right?"
Tynedra demanded of him, even as she ducked her head beneath his arm and firmly pulled it about her tiny shoulders. He nodded, though his knees almost buckled.
"Lean on me,"
she told him. He was about to protest, but she put her hand firmly to his lips.
"Don't argue, Geryon,"
she told him.
"You know that I love you, and that you're going to be leaning on me for the rest of your life anyway, so you might as well get used to the idea."
"I think my life's going to be different now, Master," Belgarath was saying to Alder. "Paul has always been there, ready to come when I called her. Not always willingly, perhaps, but she always came. Now she'll have other concerns," he sighed. "I suppose our children all grow up and get married sometime. This particular pose doth not become thee, my son," Alder told him.
Belgarath grinned.
"I have never been able to slip anything past you, Master," he said.
Then his face grew serious again.
"Olgara's been almost like a son to me," he told Alder. "But perhaps it is time that I let her be a woman. I have denied her that for too long." "As it seemeth best to thee, my son," Alder said. "And now I pray thee, go apart a little way, and permit us our family grief."
He looked at Torak's body lying on the bier and then at Geryon.
"I have but one more task for thee, Belgarion. Take the orb and place it upon my brother's breast."
"Yes, master,"
Geryon replied immediately. He removed his arm from around Tynedra's shoulders and walked to the bier, trying not to look at the dead god's seared and twisted face. He reached out and laid the round blue stone upon the motionless chest of Kal Torak. Then he stepped back. Once again his little princess wormed her way beneath his arm and clasped him about the waist. It was not unpleasant, but he had the brief, irrational thought that things would be awkward if she was going to insist on this close embrace for the rest of their lives.
Once again the gods formed their circle, and once again the orb began to glow. Gradually, the seared face started to change, its maiming slowly disappearing. The light surrounding the gods and the bier grew stronger, and the glow of the orb became incandescent. The last Geryon saw of the face of Torak, it was calm, composed, and unmarked. It was a beautiful face, but it was nonetheless still a dead face. And then the light grew so intense that Geryon could no longer look at it. When it subsided, and when Geryon looked back at the bier, the gods and the body of Torak were gone. Only the orb remained, glowing slightly as it lay there on the rough stone. Arand once again, with that confident look, went to the bier. Standing on his tiptoes, he reached across the block to retrieve the glowing stone. Then he carried it to Geryon.
"Arand, Belgarion,"
he said firmly, handing the orb back, and in their touch as the orb exchanged hands, Geryon felt something profoundly different. Drawn together by what had happened, the little group silently gathered about Aunt Paul and Durnik. To the east, the sky had begun to lighten, and the rosy blush of dawn touched the few last remaining tatters of the cloud that had covered Klaul Mishrak. The events of the dreadful night had been titanic, but now the night was nearly over, and they stood together, not speaking, as they watched the arrival of the dawn. The storm that had raged through the long night had passed. For years beyond counting, the universe had been divided against itself, but now it was one again. If there were such things as beginnings, this was a beginning. And so it was, through broken cloud, that the sun rose on the morning of the first day. Epilogue. The Isle of the Winds. Chapter 25. Belgarion of Reba slept very fitfully the night before his wedding. Had he and Senedra been married in some simple, private little ceremony shortly after his meeting with Torak, things might have gone more smoothly. At that time, both he and his flighty little princess had been too tired and too overwhelmed by the events which had taken place to be anything but absolutely honest with each other. During those few short days he had found her to be almost a different person. She had watched his every move with a kind of patient adoration, and she was forever touching him, his hair, his face, his arms, her fingers gentle and curious. The peculiar way she had of coming up to him, no matter who was present or what was going on, and worming her way into the circle of his arm had been, on the whole, rather nice. Those days had not, however, lasted. Once she had reassured herself that he was all right, and that he was really there and not some figment of her imagination which might be snatched away at any moment, Zenedra had gradually changed. He felt somehow like a possession. Following her initial delight in ownership, his princess had rather deliberately embarked upon some grand plan of alteration. And now, the day upon which her possession of him was to be formalized was only hours away. His sleep came in fits and starts, with dreams mingling peculiarly with memories as he dipped in and out of sleep like a seabird skimming across the waves. He was at Faldor's farm again. Even in his sleep he could hear the ringing of Durnik's hammer, and the smell and the odor coming from Aunt Paul's kitchen was there. Rundrig was there too, and Zubret and Dorun, and there was Brill creeping around a corner. He half awoke and turned restlessly in the royal bed. That wasn't possible. Dorun was dead, drowned in the River Mardu.